So today we're going to be dealing with the question of poverty alleviation. Just those two words have already made some people tune out. It's not your problem. I've only got a little bit to live on. Don't expect me to part with the little bit that I have. Your thoughts might have immediately gone to the fact that we don't need this sermon in this church. Take the sermon to Sandton or to Constantia or to Umhlanga. They can sort out poverty alleviation. It's got nothing to do with us. Maybe you're thinking, please don't make me feel bad about the little bit of money that I earn. I just eke out a frugal existence. By all means, let the rich give to the poor. If they're willing to let go of their hard-earned cash, don't make me feel uncomfortable about what belongs to me. But if you tuned out on that basis, the Lord's got a couple of words to us. Where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. If our treasure is on earthly things and we hold on to them, well, that's what matters to you. Recognize that possibly speaking about this subject is hitting at your treasure. And your defense might come from what you treasure the most. And it's not the Lord Jesus Christ, it's what you can earn in this world. Surprising that there might be as much backlash, it's surprising that there's not as much backlash to the giving to the poor as there is to the allowing the rich to keep what they have. I don't think Hiltonians really understand what it is to be poor. You might respond by saying, yes, there are some Hiltonians who don't understand what poverty is. I think Hiltonians understand what it means to be broke. You just don't manage your money wisely and you don't get to the end of the month without your money running out. I don't think you understand what poverty is about. All we need to do is change priorities and maybe we can make the money last to the end of the month. But there are some people who are in poverty and they've got to make serious choices. I was reading an article written in the Guardian newspaper. And it made a distinction that I think is really reasonable, and I want to quote that paragraph. This is the quote. There is a big difference between being broke and being poor. Poverty is the daily agony of not having enough money for groceries, or having to decide between buying food for your children or paying rent. Real poverty is isolating. It's living in fear of who will find out and how you will be judged. It's worrying whether the social workers will pitch up on your door tomorrow and take your children away. Why do we become so protective over what we believe belongs to us? I think it's because we believe we've earned it. We've put in hard work and that it's ours. We've got a right to keep what we have earned. Being attached to something that you have is nothing new. It was there right back in 450 years before Jesus came to this earth. Days of Nehemiah. We can't escape this emotional intensity of everything that happens around poverty. Look at the first 8 verses and it's nothing new. Just glancing down, if you've got your Bibles open in Nehemiah chapter 5. Look at the first 8 verses and you're dealing with the Bible. And you can tune in again if you tuned out for my introduction, but this has got nothing to do with you at the moment. It's got to do with the Bible. So have a look at the emotional intensity of the first 8 verses. Verses 1 and 2. There are people who cry out against their brothers. Their own flesh and blood have grain, and they've got bigger families, and they've got nothing to eat, and their brothers won't even assist them. Verse 3 tells of some who would sell capital assets just to put bread on the table. Never a wise move, but that's where they'd got to. Verse 4 speaks of those so heavily taxed by their own people that they're starving. Verses 5 and 6 speak about those who have sold their younger family members into slavery in their own nation so that they can keep the rest of their family fed, prevent starvation setting in. Have you any idea how demeaning it would be if you had to give your own child to your brother so that you can put food on the table. And it worked just for a little while. And just in that short space of time, you've run out of food once again. And so you've got to look at your next child and say, maybe I can put my next child into slavery as well. And in so doing, feed my family for another year. What would it be like going to your brother's house and seeing your children abused because they're slaves in your brother's home, and your sister-in-law is doing whatever she wants with your daughter? What eats you up is that there's still poverty in your home, and the rising costs and the basic necessities mean that you've got to close your ears to your children crying for help. What would a righteous leader do? I don't believe he's just going to sit down quietly and pretend everything's okay and let's sweep it under the rug and just pretend it's going to go away, because it's not. His own countrymen are coming to him and saying, this is what's happening in our own land. Is God for us or against us? What do we do? And Nehemiah calls a massive meeting to address this issue. And out of this intense emotion, he's not prepared to have the people with money saying, okay, we'll just pay you a little bit more and just keep quiet about it. Nehemiah is not the sort of guy who's going to get bought out by a rich individual or by a group or consortium of people just to spare their own interests. Nehemiah calls this gathering of all people in order to address the problem of poverty in their own environment. It's not designed to manipulate the officials, but it comes from this deep and heartfelt pain of knowing that his people had been slaves before. 1,000 years earlier, they were slaves in Egypt, and God released them from that slavery. 30 years earlier, they were slaves in Persia, and God had released them from that. And he's saying, did God really release us just to make us slaves to our own brothers once again? How warped is that? That we are saved from this foreign invasion and we are released as from being prisoners of war, basically, and then we are becoming loan sharks to the people who are our own flesh and blood. It's emotive. For those who don't want to think about it, you can tune out again. But my question to real Christians is, what is your feeling about the poor? Do you care about them at all? Isn't it easier just to distance yourself emotionally from them? Wind up your window, pay no attention to them, ignore them, they'll go away. We've become cynical and hard-hearted. We've become patronizing in the things that we've got. Worse than that, we've become possessive and greedy. We've enjoyed the good things that God has given to us. We're not prepared to let go of anything. And if we do, we want to make a profit. Wouldn't it be good to have a good discussion about land redistribution at this point? Wouldn't it be great if I just turned the microphone off, we stopped the recording, and we just said, okay, so what do we believe about it? Because where our treasure is, that's where our heart will really be. I don't believe that the answer is land redistribution without compensation. I don't believe we just perpetuate the sins of the past. But we've really got to think hard about how much we are holding on to that which we desperately believe is ours. How can we accept from God all that he's given to us and not show kindness and mercy to others? We refuse to see that there's a problem of poverty, and we take the advantages we've been given as personal entitlement to make money out of other people who have less than we do. It's an emotive issue. So we look at the intensity, and from there we move on to this divine intermediary, who is Nehemiah. There's no half-hearted faith in Nehemiah. He's full on. If you're following Yahweh, if you're following the God of the Bible, then you can't carry on just doing what you used to do. There needs to be a change in your heart. There needs to be a change in my life. There needs to be a change in the way that we respond to people. Other than that, or don't call yourself a believer. You can't carry on doing exactly as you want to do, affirming that God, by the confession of your lips, is still your God, unless you see the emotional intensity of the things that really affect our country. If you're not seeing the consistencies, then you can be no witness at all to the surrounding nations. So in verses 9 through to 13, Nehemiah is saying, do you realize that the nations around us are watching? They want to see what we're doing. They believe that God released us from the hands of the Persians to do what? Just to become as cold and callous as they were to us, to our own countrymen? Lord forbid. There are inconsistencies in the way that we live. If we have got lots of money, maybe we can put our hands deep into our pocket and just say, I'm going to give some money to it and maybe it will go away. Maybe that's not what the Lord is calling us to. Maybe God's calling us to our time, because that's our treasure. And giving up our time to people who really would want to know a little bit more. But we've got this wealth of knowledge and we're not prepared to share it with them unless we give you extra lessons and we'll charge you for them. Thank you very much. Well, maybe it's the talents that we've got. The gifts that God has given to us. The ability to work with our hands. Practical abilities. You've got resources. You've got gifts. Imagine if Nehemiah said, well, thanks very much, Lord. I know you've called me to go back to my own people, but I'm quite comfortable here in the palace. I'm not going to leave Babylon. I've got everything that I could want. They're probably there because of their own fault, their own stupidity, their own failings to keep what was given to them in the first place. Nehemiah didn't do that. We've got plenty of time for that which we consider to be important. We'll always find time for the people that we love, for our favorite pastimes and pursuits, for the social activities we need to do, for our own personal enjoyments. We find time. We make time. And if the Lord's not the Lord of our time, then we'll say, I don't have time to do this. I'm too busy to do that. Can't you find somebody else who can help? If the Lord doesn't feature in the work that we do or the time that we sacrifice, he's no longer our Lord. Just greedy individuals, seeing the greatness of God, saying thanks very much, and not giving back. Sometimes I wonder about how the people listening to Jesus received the words that he spoke. Remember, Jesus told the parable of the unmerciful servant? There was a rich man who was owed a great amount of money by his servant. And he called the servant in one day, and he said to the servant, give me back everything that I owe. And said, I've got no money left. And he said, all right, that's fine. We'll take you and your family and we'll throw you into jail. And the servant fell at the master's feet and said, please have mercy on me. I will pay back. And the master forgave him his whole debt. That servant then went to another servant who owed him a couple of pence, grabbed him by the throat and said, give me back everything you owe me. This man fell to his knees and said, please, give me a little bit of time. I will get the money together. But the man had no compassion on him. Threw him into jail with his family until he paid every last cent. What do you think would go through the minds of the people who were listening to that parable from Jesus? How wicked that unmerciful servant was, who was released from a huge debt and demanded a couple of cents from his fellow servant. Surely if he's been released from such great debt, could he not forgive the man who owed him little? Do you think they just put it onto a spiritual thing? and just thought, wow, look at all that God has done for me. Look at all the gifts he has given to me. This is wonderful stuff, but I don't need to pass it on to anybody else. I've just got to pass on spiritual gifts. I don't think they thought that at all. I think they realized that God had given them abundantly in this world, the things of this world, that they were to pass it on to others as well. It's the practical evidence of what Nehemiah actually does. Because Nehemiah works that out in his own life. Look down to verses 15 and 16. Their assistants also lorded over the people, but out of reverence for God, Nehemiah says, I did not act like that. Instead, I devoted myself to work on this wall. All my men were assembled there for the work. We did not acquire any land. Here you've got the person who could own the biggest tract of land in Israel. He said, that's not what interested me. My last point to note, having looked at emotional intensity and divine, decisive intermediary, is to see God's integrity coming through Nehemiah. We ought to be people who do what we do because we serve God, not out of some warped idea that we're going to be thanked for or it's going to be noted in the annals of history. No, I know that serving God is not a uniquely Christian idea. There are lots of people who do good. There are lots of people who help others. There are lots of people who give to the poor. There are organizations that supply meals all day, every day. And sometimes unbelievers even outstrip believers in terms of the magnitude or their attitude in giving. But their focus is certainly not the God of the Bible. When the lavishness of God is poured out on Christians, it's not ours for us to keep. It's entrusted to us just for a little while. We ought to be good managers of all that is entrusted to us. So how does that work its way out practically? What are we supposed to do? Well, if we see that provision that God entrusts to us as a loan, it becomes incidental. And what we owe God then takes priority and becomes everything to us. Out of reverence for Yahweh, Nehemiah did not act like all the others who allowed others to carry the burdens of financial strain. Even though the offer of food assistance was there, Nehemiah could eat the choicest of food and as much as he liked. And he didn't follow the way of all the other nobles. I want to put that into a South African context just for a moment. I want to suggest that there is a politician in our parliament who decides he's not going to take the salary that is given to him. He's going to live off 20% of the salary that he gets. And he gives 80% of his salary away. Doesn't lend it so that he can get interest on it. He just gives it away. He looks after people. Out of that 20%, he loans other people some money and doesn't charge interest. They offer him massive car allowances. And he says, yeah, I think I'll take the Toyota Corolla, thank you. Sorry, I'm asking your imagination to run wild at this point because that's all it is. Imagine this guy doesn't have the particular brand label on his clothes, but everybody recognizes his outfit from Mr. Price. Just imagine for a while. Wouldn't you look at that person and say, that's a politician I admire? How much more if that politician was a Christian and he could say, I'm not doing it for myself, I'm doing it because God has given me so much. I can't expect to live in this house with this salary and these cars when other people are going through poverty, destitution, and they sold their daughter into prostitution to feed their family. Imagine as a Christian what a witness it would be. Yeah, all the surrounding nations were watching Nehemiah. Like Moses, he would forgo the blessings of a great life so he could identify with those whom he served. What a man. Moses had the opportunity to be a prince in Egypt, second only to Pharaoh. And he said, I'm going to turn my back on that and I'm going to walk with the Israelites. And I will eat manna and quail and water that comes out of a rock rather than the pleasures of Egypt. Imagine if Christians today would do that. These three points show the problem and how Nehemiah proved himself to love the Lord more than he loved himself. If he loved God with all his heart, with all his soul, with all his mind, with all his strength, it has to translate into loving his neighbor, even though they may not deserve it or require it. I was struck by a conversation I had with a bishop, KwaZulu-Natal bishop, a couple of weeks ago. We were talking about the difficulties that our own denomination had. And I said, I've got a thought as to how we might be able to assist ministers in their finances. And he said, John, it's not about money. It's about expertise. It's about people walking alongside of us. There are churches that aren't even banking the money that they receive, the meager amount that they receive Sunday by Sunday, because they don't know how to bank properly. And if they withdraw, they withdraw a whole big amount, and then it just dwindles away and nobody knows where it goes. We need people who can help us and show us better systems. Have I got time? I've got to make time. It's not a case of whether I've got 5 minutes left at the end of the week. It's a question of making 2 hours a week to do something about it. There's emotional intensity in it. There's a decisive intermediary with everybody who says, Lord, here am I. I can give my time and my talents and my finances. And then there's godly integrity to do it as to the Lord. David Platt has done some really useful work on the subject. I recommend that you either get one of the books that he's written or go onto the website. There's a lot on the web with David Platt working on that. But as you do so, think about how God has worked in your heart and see how much you can give and how little we care for people within the 10 kilometer radius of our church. I'm not necessarily speaking even of the people in Mpopomeni or Sweetwaters or elsewhere. I'm speaking about people in our church. Do you even know if some of the pensioners can make ends meet? What are you doing about it? Because David Platt says it's not just a case of putting your hand in your pocket, giving them some money and hoping that the problem's going to go away. Getting involved with people. To close with, I'm going to give you 7 pointers that he's left with me. And if you want the summary of those 7, or if you want the 7 points, they are in the foyer at the door. But let me just go through those 7 points very briefly. Walk humbly with materially poor people as Christ transforms both of you. It's not God changing your life, it's God changing our lives. And it's walking with people saying, I want to learn, and I want to grow, and I want to be with you as we grow together. Second point. Do you think I can read that? Let me read it to you. Be willing to learn from materially poor people. The fact that they have fewer financial resources doesn't imply that they're less spiritual or that they've got nothing to teach you. Let me see if I can get that one back again. No? Okay, we'll go for point number 3. And point number 3 is just as bad as that. All right. Point number 3. Start by focusing on the assets and gifts of materially poor people rather than on the resources they appear to be lacking. Start by focusing on the assets and gifts of poor people. In other words, he's saying, don't go in and say, I think you need a stove before you need a TV. Look at what assets they've got and find out what their priorities are. Just a very brief aside. I've got 2 minutes. I was known by the black ministers in our congregation as the minister without a belt. It wasn't because my pants fell up. It was just because in some cultures, the belt is a bit of a status symbol. If you've got good clothes, if you've got a good belt, it means you're something. It means you're someone. And the man with no belt meant, sure, he doesn't care for himself very much. You see, it's just a different perspective. It's something that is not part of my culture. Mouse wears braces. That keeps his trousers up. Practical purpose. Wear belts to keep our trousers up. It's not a status symbol. But unless I understand where somebody else is coming from, I don't go in and say, oh, by the way, you need braces because I'm wearing them. It's understanding who they are and how that all fits together in his own mind. Let me see if this next one works. Do not simply provide handouts of material resources to able-bodied people over long periods of time. Ask them to contribute something for their own improvement. I was working with an NGO just over a year ago, and they said, if you go in as a church and you repaint the people's church for them, they're going to wait until it falls to pieces once again, and then they're going to phone you up and say, oh, by the way, we need another coat of paint, please. No, we've been doing that. That's a paternalistic culture in which we've lived. And because we've provided and we've painted for them, whenever they need it again, they're going to phone us and say, please, can you provide it again? It's not us working for them. It's contributing something that would give them a sense of value, a sense of worth. I don't know if you've ever been in a position where you've depended on somebody giving you something month by month and you couldn't do without it. It's demeaning. It's embarrassing. Allow them to know that they're worth something by contributing something that they can contribute. Three more points very briefly. As much as possible, stop doing things to or for materially poor people and start doing things with them. Number six, remember that it's all about empowering people, not dispensing products. Platt in his books indicates that we don't become this automatic vending machine. What's the good of paying black churches and helping them to sort out their finances if it's still going into no bank account and get siphoned off somewhere else? It's not dispensing products. It's empowering people. Last point, very briefly. Make sure your approach is rooted in and leads back to the local church, because the local church is the very embodiment of Jesus Christ, the only one who can restore people to proper relationships with God, self, others, and the rest of creation. The focal point of all of our giving is not to appease a conscience. Point them back to Christ and say, just as God has given me so much freely, freely I give. Do you care about the poor? It might just mean taking your lawnmower to somebody's house and mowing their lawn for them. Let's close in prayer.